How can we promote stronger brain change in our clients? We've been looking at the many different patterns that can keep our clients stuck. But Dr. Rick Hansen knows that neuroplasticity can be a key for unlocking powerful and lasting change. Here, Rick shares how to rewire the three-part stuck cycle.
I think it's first important to include the body and the world. In other words, to acknowledge not just mental factors that get people stuck, which I'll speak to, but to realize that, you know, we live in relationship with the whole world and other people. So if we're in a situation where it's just dangerous, literally, to be anything other than extremely tightly contained and careful and stuck, well, that's something important to recognize. It's also in terms of the body. If we're ill or we have a physical condition, that's going to stick us as well. So acknowledging and bowing to, in some sense, the world and the body, and naming that we need to do something about it, then let's talk about the mind. I think first we need to also take into account innate factors, our temperament. Some people are naturally anxious. Others are naturally melancholy. Some people are naturally kind of irritable. Some people are naturally a little more even-keeled and cheerful. Temperament matters, and as part of temperament, cognitive style, some people just innately have a greater degree of openness. Other people tend toward a greater rigidity in their cognitive style. So again, acknowledging temperament, and then focusing on what we can do something about, that which is acquired. That's what we can do about, something about from the inside out, and as coaches, therapists, healthcare providers, and so forth, what we can do for other people. And that takes me then to something I've thought a lot about, which is the idea that much of our stuckness is due to a desire to not risk the dreaded experience. In other words, you'll see again and again and again that we start out in life, things happen. We experience pain when certain circumstances occur, let's say in our families as kids or as an adult. Or we observe other people experiencing pain, being upset, being wounded, being traumatized when certain things happen to them, or they make certain choices, or we imagine these things happening. And then what occurs is deep inhibition on true self-expression of the authentic self. And you'll see a cycle that has kind of like three steps to it, or I think about it as laps around a triangular track, in which first what arises is the natural expression of the true self. We feel something, maybe it arises inside our own mind, or maybe what arises is a natural desire to express something, such as assertiveness or a request for love, a vulnerable request. Something is there. And then in the second step, the second leg of the triangular track, is the expectation of pain, the dreaded experience, you know, that I'll be wounded or attacked or punished, or I won't get what I want, or I'll be shamed, I'll look stupid, others will leave me, I'll be abandoned, I'll look like a fool, whatever it might be. And then the third leg of the triangular track is the defense against true self-expression. And all this happens very rapidly most of the time and unconsciously. And often we discover it in ourselves, or we see it in others when we're observing the defense, like the inhibition on full self-expression. And that defense can be quite subtle. It can look like just leaning back in an interaction, or making a joke, or intellectualizing, or picking a quarrel, or numbing the body, or just really avoiding even from the get-go certain situations, certain opportunities, like a business opportunity that would involve more public speaking, or a relationship opportunity that would involve more closeness. And so then we work backwards from the defense. We start with the defense. We start with a coping strategy, which made sense maybe, probably, when we were 3 years old or 33 years old. But today it's like walking around in a suit of armor that's three sizes too small. And the trick then, which will probably take us to a new topic, is to gradually, in a very step-by-step, careful way, take managed risks of the dreaded experience, from the inside out, helping yourself, or from the outside in, drawing on others, or as a therapist or coach, helping others gradually take risks so that, and then when it goes well, which it usually does, which I'll speak to about more soon, I'm sure, then really internalize the results. So that's been incredibly useful for me as a therapist, longtime therapist, to observe this three-legged track, the triangular track, and the avoidance of risking the dreaded experience in myself and in others, and then using it as an opportunity for growth to unwind that very understandable process through repeatedly internalizing positive experiences when it actually goes well and you risk, when you do risk it.
So how do you internalize the positive experience?
Yeah, that goes to a lot of things I've developed around positive neuroplasticity, informally described as taking in the good, definition being the deliberate internalization of beneficial experiences, mainly in implicit memory. That's not so much the explicit recollections, the explicit memory of things that have happened, but letting it sink into the body. For example, that when you take one step up of risk, and let's say speaking from your heart or asking for what you really need or speaking truth to power or naming an injustice or simply being aware of your own internal experience, when it goes well, stay with that experience long enough that the passing mental state can become encoded as a lasting neural trait. There's no magic number in terms of the duration of the experience. The longer you stay with it, the better. There's a really technical term I frequently use, MoBeta. In other words, more episodes of embodied emotional learning that's beneficial and more intensity of engagement in each episode. My rough rule of thumb is 5, 10, 20 seconds in a row, stay with it. Help those neurons keep firing together so they really wire together and internalize that beneficial experience. Otherwise, most of our passing experiences, as you know, pass through the brain like water through a sieve. Meanwhile, our negative experiences, moments of pain, moments of upset, moments of anxiety, moments of stress, moments of feelings of inadequacy, and so forth, get rapidly encoded in lasting neural structures because of the brain's innate and evolved negativity bias. I say it's like Velcro for the bad, but Teflon for the good. If you think about it, to kind of summarize it and put it simply, what's a person's learning curve as they go through their day when they're having opportunities for beneficial experiences, usually ones they've already had, an experience of grit, an experience of closeness with another person, a moment of insight and therapy, a moment of gratitude, a moment of feeling cared about by other people, everyday experiences that are usually already occurring, commitment to social justice, a commitment to their personal sobriety. When they're having these experiences, what's the learning rate from them? Are they simply a passing moment, or do they actually have some lasting value? As therapists and coaches and so on, we're in the business of learning, of brain change. If we can increase the average rate of growth from a person's everyday experiences, that's the X factor. That's the magic, not magic, but that's the most important thing in the world, because you're changing your rate of learning. So as you go through your day, instead of it being flat or kind of shallow, you actually have a steep learning curve. It's the whole thing about, do you give a person a fish or do you teach them how to fish? And I think it's critically important, actually, to teach people the how of positive brain change. And then they can use that how of positive brain change and apply it to any sort of inner strength, any sort of mental resource that they want to develop over time.
As Rick said, when we pull back the curtain, teach clients how brain change works, it can make a real difference in their treatment. But how do we help patients savor those good experiences that rewire the brain? Here are some thoughts from Dr. Kelly McGonigal, Dr. Joan Borisenko, and Bill O'Hanlon.
I take a lot from the science of mindset interventions, which says if you really want to help someone embody an idea and learn something new, the process of learning is narrative and the process of learning is social. So you need people to tell a story in which that learning is reflected, and you need people to share their insight with someone else. And so I think if you think about savoring then as being kind of a three-part process, you have to notice it in the moment. If you don't notice it in the moment, it's going to be really hard to do anything else with it. But in addition to just letting it sort of breathe in your body, oh, this is what it feels like to be of service to someone. Oh, this is what it feels like to do something that I experienced self-doubt, but I did it anyways. This is what courage feels like. Then at the end of the day, maybe you write about it. You think like, what experience that I have today that really was an example of whatever it is that people are working towards or want to experience? So they savor it in that way. and they tell the experience as a story. And writing is a really good format for this. But so is telling someone else about it. And it, you know, it could be in therapy, but it could be with your spouse. Or I have students now who tell me that they are doing these exercises with their cats, which I love as someone who has cats. They are telling these stories and ideas to their cats, and it's fine because there's something about that social relationship in which learning goes deeper. And so I would think that anything that people are trying to learn to savor in the hopes that it will rewire their brain. So this is a new way of thinking and feeling and becoming a habit of mind to savor it, to tell it as a story, and especially to tell it as a story to somebody else. So if you look at, so these are all the mindset interventions. Many of them are coming out of Stanford University, and there are different ideas that are trying to be conveyed. A good example would be Greg Walton's belonging interventions, David Yeager's change is possible interventions, even Carol Dweck's growth mindset interventions. The way that those mindset interventions really work is you present someone with an idea, whether it's through stories they hear or scientific data, and then you ask them, like, is this true in your experience? Can you maybe write a little bit about an experience you've had that reflects this? And then you also ask them to explain that idea to someone else. And mindset interventions that include all of those elements seem to have really deep lasting events, even if people can't even remember the mindset intervention. You know, the best example of that is Greg Walton's first study of his belonging intervention, where 4 years later, nobody in the study could remember what the study was about, but they had massive changes in terms of personal well-being and success and physical health. But they didn't even remember it, but it had changed the way that they interpreted their experiences.
Well, I've been doing the same practice for 30 years, and every time I give a lecture, almost every time, I instruct people in this practice. And it's something my husband and I do every day before we go to bed. So what's the magic practice? It's a gratitude practice. And I learned it from Brother David Steindl Rast, who wrote a book called Gratefulness, The Heart of Prayer. And what he said, and he's also a Zen teacher, he's in his 80s now. He said, every day, find one thing that you've never been grateful for before. And it might be something like the sudden way that somebody's face lights up when they smile, or it has to be something really particular that you notice, something beautiful. I live in New Mexico. When the magic light comes and it lights up the mountain sometimes, you can't help it. You cry because the awe and the beauty is so great. And the idea is to notice these moments. And then when you go to bed, to think of one of them and really bring it back, which is Rick Hansen is saying, you got to spend 15, 20 seconds to rewire your brain. So you bring it back in a multidimensional way, all of your senses, the experiences, if it was happening. So this is not the kind of gratitude practice where you sit and you say, I'm grateful for my work, I'm grateful for my family. I mean, all that stuff is great. But the Steindl Rast, being grateful for one thing that really happened that day that you're rerunning in your mind, what it does is it makes you more mindful in daily life because you know you got to come across with this at night before you go to bed. So you're looking all day long for those sweet little precious moments, and you begin to string together more and more like a string of pearls until you become a much more mindful, present, grateful person. It works like a charm.
Well, I mean, this is really my wheelhouse because this is the work that I've done, and an approach I created called the solution-oriented approach. And we have a lot of techniques, but I'll just mention one here. When someone mentions something that's going well, or that's an exception to the problem, or that's a solution, we don't just let it pass by. We say, well, tell me more about that. What happened then? And how did you, what did you notice? And how did so-and-so respond? And so we just spend a little more time asking about it. And I'll give you an example of this. So I had a client who I was working with, and she came in one time and she said, you know, that last session was really great. For about 3 days after the session, I was doing really well. You know, everything was going great. And then I just crashed and burned. And she started to talk about all the things that had gone wrong since she crashed and burned. I said, wait. You know, you went past that part a little quickly. What went better? Why was the last session so good? What was so helpful about it? And we went over that a little. And then I said, and then what happened when you left here? She said, well, I did this and I noticed this and I changed this. And we spent about 15 minutes, not just 15 seconds, talking about that stuff before we went on and talked about how she crashed and burned. So it's partly just a matter of attending to it and being a little more curious about it. And then, you know, what you focus on expands, as, you know, Rick said. And I think just asking about it more is the simplest way to bring it to the foreground and regroup.
As we've heard, effective brain change often needs both the awareness and the shift in the way that we engage with our experiences. In the next module, we'll look at some practical ways to resource clients to get themselves unstuck. I'll see you there.